Hello, or perhaps I should say Namaskar, a typical greeting used in the Indian region of West Bengal, because the subject of this edition of the Tennis Worthy podcast comes from there, and he's one of India's greatest tennis players. I'm Patrick McEnroe, president of the International Tennis Hall of Fame, which acts as a guardian of the sport's history and produces the Tennis Worthy podcast. And today, we have a fascinating interview with Leander Paes.
So I asked my dad, you know, this is a check. I don't have a bank account. Why didn't you take the paper and give me the cash? And he said, what are you going to do with it? I said, buy myself an ice cream parlor. He said, an ice cream parlor? I said, yeah, I want to own an ice cream factory. He said, well, you're going to have to win Wimbledon for that. A tennis ball or a football or a cricket ball does not understand the culture, the dialect, the religion, the party you support, or the color of your skin. It understands the passion you have, the hard work you've put in, and understands what force of energy you put onto that ball. The unconditional love that a parent should give a child is the greatest message that I want to send out to all the parents. To teach through fear doesn't last, but to teach through love leaves a DNA in that child's mind even long after you're gone. That my mom, my dad gave me love.
Leander was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2024 as a result of being one of tennis's greatest ever doubles players. And as you'll hear over the next hour, he's more than just an athlete. He's a very thoughtful man who's always been aware of his social responsibilities and is keen to show gratitude to all those who help him. Chris Bowers sat down with Leander Paes the day after his induction. And I'll tell you now, this interview is only partly about tennis. It also covers ethical, spiritual, medical, and other elements of how to be simply as good a human being as you can. All yours, Chris.
Leander Paes, we're recording this the day after you became a Hall of Famer. Have you given any thought to what you feel the attribute or attributes are that makes someone a Hall of Famer?
Good afternoon, Chris. I have always wondered about that. I always wondered about what are the attributes that would determine whether the jury would select me or not, or determine whether the past Hall of Famers would select me or not. I knew I had the fan voting down because of sheer population back in India. But in my humble estimation, I feel like it's more about the human being that one is, the relationship one has, the way one has conducted oneself, the way one has inspired generations over the last 38 years of playing professional tennis. I think also it's about what I have stood for, about how clean and honest I've played the game and how hard I've played the game on the court, but yet about being a gentleman off of it. I think these attributes are weighed quite heavy beyond the 7 Olympics I've played or the Grand Slams or the world record in Davis Cup of 45 undefeated wins or even coveting an Olympic medal. I think being a good human being is even more important than the accolades of trophies.
So if it's both achievements and what you've stood for, what would you like people to think you did stand for?
I would love to hear from the fans as to what their perceptions of me are, because I think when I grew up in a country of 1.4 billion people, I mean different things to different people. It's how I do it is what I'm concerned about, not necessarily what their interpretations are of what I stand for. How I do it in the sense of goodness, honesty, happiness, fair play, empowerment, inspiration, aspirational. A lot of young kids would like to be us Hall of Famers. I knew as a young kid, when I met Richard Evans on the 12th of May 1986, my goal was to emulate my father and win an Olympic medal. And he was the one who told me what a Hall of Famer could be. Because he inspired me then as an 11-year-old, saying that if you work hard enough, you could also be a Hall of Famer. Ironic that he was trying to steal my medal yesterday in the mix-up that happened with medals. But also karma, that eventually I got Richard Evans to basically put a medal on my neck, and it was the Hall of Fame medal.
Because it was a mix-up of you happened to have his and he happened to have yours.
Karma is what I call it. Mix-up or mistake or divine intervention. You can call it what we want, which comes back again in terms of perceptions.
Maybe you're an undiscovered great writer, then.
Oh, boy. If I could be as articulate as my fellow Hall of Famer, I think that would be wonderful.
You mentioned when you were 11 years old. You've told the story often about how you were a street footballer and a street cricketer playing barefoot in Calcutta, as it then was, Kolkata, as it is now. Can you paint the picture? What does it mean to be playing street cricket and street football barefoot in an Indian city in the 1970s?
So I grew up the youngest of three kids. I had two elder sisters, one 7 years older, one 4 years older. Father was an Olympic champion in the 72 Munich Olympics. Mom was captaining Indian basketball. Dad was also a doctor of medicine. But every day at breakfast, lunch or dinner, we have young kids who were orphans who would come and sit on the dining table with us and eat food with us. Those were the kids I played street cricket and street football with. So I would share my shirts, share my shorts, share my books. But I didn't have enough shoes to share with them. So hence I figured it would be unfair if I played with shoes and they played bare feet. Because I didn't want to trample on their little toes, or I didn't want to kick harder, because I had the privilege of being born into the family I was born into that could provide socks and shoes, let alone provide football boots for football and tennis shoes for tennis and running shoes for running and so on and so forth. So I decided as a young man to take my shoes and socks off and play fair. So we all played on the street, and in one context, I guess it got me a little more rugged. It got me to understand the privilege that I was born into and never to take that for granted. But more importantly, it taught me about empathy, about sharing. It taught me about understanding the person in front of you on what their strengths, weaknesses are, and what their positions are. And hence, inspiring people and bringing them happiness is my single-minded focus.
You were primarily a footballer. That was your main focus as a child. And then you had a setback in the sense that you were told you couldn't play football. Why did you end up picking tennis, which is not a team sport?
It wasn't that they told me that I could not play football, but because I grew up with a Bengali mother and a Portuguese father, football was my number one sport. Mum captained Indian basketball. Dad got a medal in field hockey. Both team sports, and I love team sports. I love the interaction of people. But when the European Football Academy asked me if I was going to stay and play at the academy, the millions of dollars that they were going to invest into my career, they could not afford to spend that money for me to go and play for the opposition, whether it was an opponent club or whether it was an opposition country.
So who was the opposition? India?
Yes. Or any other country that I wanted to play for. It could be even Portugal. Because with my father's Portuguese background from Goa, it would not be too difficult for me to get a Portuguese passport. But it would not be too difficult for me, with my mother's background, part Indian and part Anglo-Indian, to get a British passport.
So who did they want you to play for, without which they wouldn't fund you?
Anyone but the club. I think it's fair if you think about it, Chris. If you were to invest in me millions of dollars, and I went and supported your opponent, wouldn't be quite right, would it?
So why then tennis?
Because I put myself in their shoes, and I understood that what they were saying from their perspective was right. But I also, as a young age, was very blessed to understand my legacy. Mum's playing jersey for India was number 5. Dad's playing jersey for India was number 10. I always wanted to play for the tricolor of India. I always wanted to inspire 1.4 billion people. And when I gave up the football scholarship and came back to Calcutta, I had a conversation with my dad over dinner. He was actually positive about me playing football because he knew how talented at soccer I was. And he almost encouraged me to go that route again until I mentioned our legacy of our family to him, and he understood where I was coming from. Now, look how gracious that is from a father who could, in a country like India, be very dominating. In a country like India, talk down to me and tell me what I should do. Or a mother and a father who could basically feel that they could run their son's life. But instead, they understood the wisdom of the son. They understood the intelligence of the son, even at the age of 11. And they gave me the respect and the unconditional love to follow my dreams. And for that, I have eternal gratitude, because I wouldn't be who I am without my parents.
There's a story that your father gave you 100 rupees and said, go and play video games, and that you thought he was just getting you out of the house. but that actually he was trying to improve your hand-eye coordination. Is that true?
Yes, it is. Isn't he the best father in the world?
Well, it's an unusual form of inculcation of skills.
You're going to have millions of kids tell their parents, see, Leander got 100 rupees. Can we get $100 too?
Well, that's
to
what
play
worries
video
me.
Games.
That's what worries me. I mean, I take it these were the old consoles where you were actually...
Right.
Yeah, so it's not, you can't do that on a tablet.
We didn't have any tablets or smart gadgets then. We had to go to the video game parlor. And my video game parlor was called Space Invaders. And right next to it was an ice cream parlor called Sub-Zero. And it was owned by my first Davis Cup captain's family. I love ice cream and I love video games. So I thought my dad was the coolest dad in the world. Every day, he would give me 100 rupees in the morning without any explanation. And I would go and play these video games. And back then, Chris, it was 1 rupee per video game. So today, I could play Pac-Man and I know the brain mapping of Pac-Man for the first hour and 5 minutes. I will not lose a life. It also taught me what we know today as artificial intelligence. It also taught me about data. It also taught me about reading someone's brain map. It also taught me about understanding someone's vulnerabilities. If you know their patterns, you know how to play them well or play them not so well and get them to do what you'd like to do in a good way.
So it was genuinely helpful for your tennis at lots of different levels.
100%, because I took it that route. Because on the second month after playing 100 video games every single day for 60 days, I was getting a bit tired, Chris. So I came back on the beginning of the third month, and one day I gave my dad 50 rupees back. And he said, what's this? I said, my hands are tired and wanted to give you the change. He said, you played only 50 games today. I said, yeah. He said, this is not for fun. I'm trying to teach you eye-hand coordination. I'm trying to teach you brain mapping. And I'm trying to teach you focus of your eyes and also quick twitch fibers to react fast to it.
So do you think there's a direct link between working at those video games and, say, the way you reacted to volleys?
100%. I feel that champions can be built. The great ones have to have certain amount of talent and a never-ending passion for excellence. But to build a Grand Slam champion or to build success in any field of life, 10,000 hours, 3 million perfect repetitions, 10 years, you can master anything. Eating with chopsticks or winning Grand Slams.
So we know where the video games helped. Was the ice cream parlor part of your tennis education?
Yes. Needless to say that I'm a huge ice cream fan. My favorite flavor of ice cream is vanilla or mint chocolate chip. And when I won my first tennis tournament at the age of 9, it was the Under 10 Championships. It was in Mumbai, which was then Bombay. And we played at the Bandra Gymkhana. And my dad took me down the road to Carter Road, and there was an ice cream guy there, an ice cream trolley called Qualities. And we sat at that ice cream trolley, and my dad said, what do you like to have? And I said, a choco bar, which is vanilla on the inside with a chocolate casing on the outside. And I had one. He said, would you like another? I said, yes. I had two. He said, would you like another? I had three. And I was so full of ice cream back then, I realized that by working hard and having the passion to continue through the days that I had fever, through the days that I was not feeling like playing, through the days that I was bored, or through the days that I sacrificed my childhood when all my other friends were going out partying, drinking, smoking, hanging out in the parks, I was out on the tennis court or the running track trying to push my body and mind beyond its boundaries, I realized I could get as much ice cream as I want. So, when I won that championships, I got 23,500 rupees. I was 9 years old. That's a massive amount of money. I thought I was the king of the world. So I asked my dad, you know, this is a check. I don't have a bank account. Why don't you take the paper and give me the cash? And he said, what are you going to do with it? I said, buy myself an ice cream parlor. He said, an ice cream parlor? I said, yeah, I want to own an ice cream factory. He said, well, you're going to have to win Wimbledon for that. I said, what's that? And he goes, that's the big tournament in England. It's the mecca of tennis. Tomorrow night, I will take you and show you what Wimbledon's all about. Because the next day, Wimbledon was starting. And I sat on the floor of my father and mother's house. And on black and white TV, I watched Martina Navratilova play. I watched Chris Evert play. I watched Bjorn Borg, John McEnroe. And both the lefties kind of caught my attention because they played serve and volley tennis. They played quick tennis. They played fast. It was very attractive. And then, over many years, I watched and learned so much that when I asked my father to take that check and give me the cash for it, and he said, you're going to have to win Wimbledon to own an ice cream factory. I said, so what else can I do with that? And he goes, you tell me. So I said, can I buy a house on the waterfront here on Carter Road? And he burst out laughing. He said, you'll have to win many Wimbledons for that. So after I won my second Wimbledon title, I invested in my own ice cream factory and I bought myself a house on Carter Road, which I still have.
So is the moral of that story that every tennis player must find their own dreams in terms of providing the motivation? Or did actually you end up having the motivation, having watched Chris Evert, Martina Navratilova on the television, to actually motivate yourself through tennis rather than the idea of having your own ice cream parlor or ice cream factory?
You see, I have this kinetic energy, and my attributes were in physical fitness, mental fitness, and emotional fitness. I'm not a very talented tennis player. I'm a little short for a tennis player. In the 80s, when I grew up, average height of a tennis player was 6'1". 90s, 6'2", 2000s, and now 6'3". I'm 5'10 on a good day. So in that, I use my God-given talents, which is my speed, my athleticism, and my misspent youth of having fast hands through the video games, to basically take on guys who are much bigger, stronger, and better technique than me. Every time I have a conversation with Andre Agassi, I'm so amazed by the champion that he is in the way that he looks at life and the way that he looks at his tennis, which is so similar. And just the other day, he was telling me about how he approached certain opponents. And not just in terms of tennis, which now both of us have retired, but in terms of life, of how we go about understanding life and all the challenges and ups and downs of our lives as individuals and how to tackle them. But really, I feel the kinetic energy that I have fires and inspires me in anything that I take up. Anything that Leander will ever do is something that he's very passionate about. Otherwise, I don't touch it.
You worked incredibly hard as a child, didn't you? I mean, you talk about being 5'10" and you say not particularly talented. I mean, yeah, we can discuss what natural talent is and what hard work is. But you worked incredibly hard. Where did that motivation come from?
I liked ice cream, Chris. I liked it a lot.
And you still like it?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so you weren't put off by having 3 or 4 ice creams in one go?
6, 7, a tub. I was in a cancer hospital in 2003, wrongfully diagnosed with a tumor in my head, and I finished a gallon of mint chocolate chip or a gallon of Rocky Road watching the U.S. Open every single night. 1 gallon at one sitting. And one of my greatest heroes and an elder champion that I look up to, Martina Navratilova, who I just won Wimbledon with the day before I went into cancer hospital, she decided not to play tennis until I came out and played with her. And I was sitting, feeling sorry for myself in the cancer hospital, eating ice cream, watching the U.S. Open and the guys play. But that's what champions are made of. I came out of the hospital and played with Navratilova in the 2004 Australian Open. And the champion that she is, every single night, 9 p.m., my phone would ring and it'd be Martina. And the first question was, how are you feeling? And I knew exactly that she had called Dr. Brown, the head of the MD Anderson, and she had found out exactly how my day went. But that's what tennis gives you. It's the camaraderie. It's the underlying code of conduct and passion and loyalty and empathy and of even opponents who beat each other up as hard as we could on the tennis court.
Did you know that as a child? Or is that just something you've learned with experience?
I was very privileged, Chris, to grow up to my parents and my family. So very young, I was the youngest mascot of the Indian basketball team, youngest mascot of the Indian hockey team. The goalkeeper's pads were bigger than me, and I used to strap them around my waist and my chest and my legs and run around with one pad because that's how small I was.
You were well protected.
I was. And also well protected by the environment I grew up in, Calcutta. I think one of the most beautiful things that Calcutta as a city taught me was loyalty, was taught me about culture, taught me about the richness of our heritage in India, and also about the diversity of the place. Calcutta was the capital of the British Empire back in the day, and the British Empire ran all of Asia out of Calcutta. Hence, we have a lot of Anglo-Indians, we have a lot of Indians, Hindus, Christians, Muslims, Punjabis, atheists, whatever you call, Buddhists. But in that diverse community and culture, I found that sport transcended religion. I found that sport transcended dialect. Sport transcended color of the skin. Sport brought people together in inclusiveness. A tennis ball or a football or a cricket ball does not understand the culture, the dialect, the religion, the party you support, or the color of your skin. It understands the passion you have, the hard work you've put in, and understands what force of energy you put onto that ball. And to me, I realized that one simple tennis ball could help me educate myself around the world, could help me educate myself about life and human beings. And also a simple thing, Chris, about just bringing happiness to people. I've always played tennis to share happiness with people in every stadium I play in. It could be one church mouse watching me on court number 76, or it could be playing at the All-In Club on center court in front of 23,500 in the stadium and the majority of 1.4 billion watching me at home.
I think if you had 23,000 watching on the center court at Wimbledon, the health and safety would be having kittens. But I know what you mean.
You know, it's a blessing to go around the world and play in Olympic stadiums and play in these magical arenas we play in, and including sitting here in the Hall of Fame, in the museum where we're sitting right now. I mean, we're surrounded by these amazing pictures and trophies and furniture and artifacts of, tennis started in the 12th century?
A form of it, yes.
You and me are sitting here today celebrating the rich history of our sport. But also look where I come from. Back then, I wouldn't have had this opportunity. I wouldn't be allowed in these hallowed halls. And I'm so grateful to the International Hall of Fame and all our Hall of Famers for sharing and shining a light on how, with a lot of hard work and passion and belief in yourself, even a young kid from Calcutta who played barefoot on the streets can be a Hall of Famer.
Shining a light brings me on to something else you did as a child. You used to shine, used to polish your dad's Olympic medal from the 1972 Olympics. Did you get any strength from that, if only through symbolism, or was that just a reflection of the fact that your dad helped inculcate into you the kind of mentality you needed to survive in a highly competitive athletic sport?
All the above. I used to come and polish dad's Olympic medal straight after church. It was a Sunday ritual. I'd sit with a dirty rag and a tin of Brasso, and I'd start polishing it up, and I'd ask him, "What is this goddess on the medal?" And he said, "That's the goddess of Athena." I asked him, "Why five rings?" He said, "They stand for the five continents on the planet." So then I'd go to my globe and the map, and I'd search for the five continents. And I'd suddenly realize that even though a man of religious faith, that there might be something to the Big Bang Theory. So it taught me about science. Because if you take the continents of a planet, not on a round globe, but on a flat map, and you start in your mind visually putting it together, they fit hand in glove. My father and my mother educated me through sport. My community in Calcutta, through the clubs, through the CCNFC club, my best friend Sunny Utup, my coaches, my trainers. That was education.
You're very emotional when you remember those names. What's the connection there? What's the connection you still have with them?
Sunny lost his father last week.
I'm sorry.
Uncle Johnny was a father figure to me. We all lived in the same building, Queen's Mansion on Park Street. They lived on the second floor, we lived on the third. And the funny part was Uncle Johnny would come back some nights and see five kids on the floor and look at his wife and say, "Usha, I thought we had two." So
he's like almost a second father to you.
He was the guiding light, North Star to me. And that's the richness of the culture in Calcutta. It's taught you about being a good human being. And the further you rise in your craft, you still come down to earth and you be a good human being, because that's what people respected you for.
So those five rings, the Olympics obviously very important to you. At the age of 23, you're in Atlanta and you're playing for a medal. Given how important it was, what was going through your mind, through your body, what was happening there as you played and ultimately won that bronze medal?
In my first Olympics in Barcelona, I did not have a main draw entry. I had to go off to Osaka, Japan, and play three qualifying matches. Then I qualified for Barcelona. And Ramesh Krishnan and myself played doubles. We beat the top seed Todd Woodbridge and John Fitzgerald in the first round. We beat the local favorites Casal Sanchez in the second round. And then in the quarterfinal match, Chris, we lost to Ivanisevic and Pirpich. And if you remember back then, both the losing semi-finalists got a bronze medal. So playing in the quarterfinals, let alone the silver and gold, but in the quarterfinals, if you win that match, you're guaranteed of a medal.
So quarterfinal was playing for a medal.
Exactly. And that would have been India's first Olympic medal in tennis. And we lost in four sets, 7-6 in the fourth. I sat on that chair in Barcelona for 2 hours on the court. And Ramesh, being the gentleman he is, he stood, sat with me for 1 hour. And then after an hour of silence, he said, "Can we go back to the locker room?" So I said, "You know, in all this young exuberance and this kinetic energy," I ranted and raved with him, saying, "You're going to retire now and I don't have any other young kids coming up. And how am I going to covet this medal that I've sacrificed my whole life for?" And his usual cool self, he goes, "Singles." And I was like, "What?" And he goes, "Tennis, there are three forms, mixed doubles, doubles, and singles." And it was like a lightning bolt hit me. It's the most simple thing in the world, but it hit me so hard that the next 4 years, I studied Stone Mountain, Atlanta, where the stadium was in the 1996 Olympics. I knew it was at an altitude of 1,250 feet. I knew the ball was going to fly high. I knew that the oxygen level was a bit lower. I knew it was going to be really sunny, so the ball was going to bounce higher. And I realized that serve and volley tennis would be perfect in Atlanta. I also realized that my chip and charge style of play would put so much pressure on the opponents in that altitude to pass me would be very difficult.
So had you not really thought of yourself as a plausible singles player up to then?
Don't forget that it was 1992, my first Olympics in Barcelona.
You were 19.
I was 19. I had won Junior Wimbledon in singles.
Yes.
I'd won the Junior US Open in singles. But 1991, my first year as a pro, I did not win one match for 11 months on the pro tour. Because I was the junior number one in singles, all the big boys, as I call them, wanted to prove a point so that I couldn't take their lunch money. So they came prepared every single time they played a Junior Wimbledon champion. It was a hard thing. My first 2 years on the pro circuit was tough.
Because you were a marked man having won the juniors.
I was a marked man having won the juniors. Also, I didn't have the great sponsorships that the other American boys, English boys, French boys had. I did not have an association like the Japanese or the Thai boys to get the things paid for. So I lived in YMCAs. I hitchhiked rides through Europe. I've got a big scar on my chest here from being mugged at New York Grand Central Station on 42nd Street. 23 stitches.
On your way back to a hostel.
Exactly right. A hostel up in Westchester that I had taken 2.5 hours to take the Metro North train into Grand Central and the Long Island Railroad from Penn Station to Port Washington to go and train with Gene Mayer, my coach. Third week, November 1991, Mayor Giuliani hadn't yet cleaned up the city, hadn't yet cleaned up Times Square. New York was dangerous back then. Hence, bottle of hooch right into my chest. 23 stitches later, I figured that I need to toughen up.
Did that put you off tennis at all?
No, it made me hungrier. See, we didn't have the benefit that the young kids have nowadays, which have so many options. I feel very, very protective of the young kids nowadays because with all these smart gadgets and living in tier one, tier two cities, they have 7, 8, 10 different options of what they could do as a profession. I was lucky in India to get a wooden tennis racket that my dad spent 50% of his monthly salary buying.
So by the time you got to Stone Mountain, just outside Atlanta, you were no longer a marked man, but you'd done your homework.
That's exactly right. I was no longer a marked man. I got in as a wildcard entry into the Olympics. I'd spent 4 years playing up in Ecuador, Quito, Bogota, Cali, Medellin, Colombia. I went up to Kobe. I played in all these altitude cities for 4 years, preparing my muscles, preparing my lungs, preparing my mindset, and brain mapping my brain to play quick, fast tennis for altitude at Atlanta. So when I got to Atlanta, I was so well prepared that I asked my father, my mother, my two sisters, I'd asked my coaches, I'd asked everybody to come because I felt that Atlanta was my Olympics to shine. And then when the draw ceremony came out and my captain at that time and myself went to see the results of the draw of who I was playing first round, Leander Paes, India, drew Pete Sampras, America, first round. My coach tapped me on my shoulder and in Indian, he said, "Koi gal nahi beta, next time chance hai," which meant, "Don't worry at all, son. You'll have another chance in 4 years." I felt something in my belly that I couldn't explain at the time, but I didn't see myself visually losing to Sampras, but I couldn't see myself even winning against him. And my intuition is very, very strong. 2 days later, when the match was called to play, we found out that Pete Sampras had withdrawn from the Olympic Games because his clothing sponsor was different to the U.S. contingent's clothing sponsorship. Instead, they put Richie Rennieberg into play, who was an excellent singles player in the top 50. I lost the first set 3-6. I won the second set 6-3. And when I was up 3-1 in the third set, Richie Rennieberg retired because his lungs were burning. I had him running for an hour and 45 minutes because I knew I was better prepared than him. Second round, I beat Nicolas Pereira. Third round, I beat Thomas Enqvist, one of my friends growing up in the juniors. He won Junior Wimbledon the year after I did. Quarterfinals, I beat Renzo Forlan. And in the semifinals, I drew, I think, one of my greatest opponents and best friends on the tour, Andre Agassi. And I was up 6-5, Andre serving 5-6, 15-40. And he hit a first serve into my body, and I pushed him down the line deep into his backhand and chipped and charged again. I ran to the net. I had the down the line covered. I had my body covered. I had the short cross court covered with the dive volley. I had my forehand smash covered, my backhand smash covered. I thought I was well positioned on the court, just left, right of center. He was under pressure. 5-6, 15-40. If I had won that first set in altitude tennis, once you put your nose ahead and win the first set in a best of three set match, it's tough to beat me. The brilliance of Andre Agassi is such that in a fraction of a second, he realized that I had everything covered and he hit the one shot that I wasn't prepared for at my face, straight at my right jaw. And he hit his double-fisted backhand so hard that I didn't have time to duck or go left and right and duck the shot. But instead, I tried to put my racket up to my face to deflect it cross-court into the open court, except a racket is 27 inches long. And I tried to get my hand out of the way so my racket strings could hit the ball. My wrist was in a vulnerable position, and as the ball hit the racket hit my face and fell down. Needless to say, I missed the shot. But more importantly, Andre had severed 70% of the tendon in my right playing wrist between my wrist and my elbow. And my racket fell, and I suddenly felt this sharp pain in my wrist. And it was so excruciating that my eyes welled up. The trainer, Dougie Spreen, came onto the court with the doctors. They tested my wrist out, looked at my little middle finger, my ring finger, my index finger. I couldn't raise any of the three. It was really painful and it started swelling. So Dougie turned to me and said, you've definitely severed some tendons here. It's better that you don't continue playing because you have a young career. You're only 23 years old and you got a whole career ahead of you. At least strap me up and let me play. You know, when you're in the middle of a match, you got so much of adrenaline burning. And you're so passionate because you got your flag flying high and you're at the Olympics. You're playing for 1.4 billion people. You're not just playing for you, right? So you're playing for a higher purpose. But Agassi was too good. He saved the next set point, won the first set 7-6, and I believe the second set 6-3. And unfortunately for me, Chris, that was the first Olympics there was a playoff for the bronze medal. It wasn't that the two losing semifinalists got a medal. And I played one of my best friends, Fernando Melingeni, 2 days later. But the evening after playing Agassi and losing to him, they put my wrist in a hard cast. They did an MRI. They confirmed that there was 70% tear of that tendon at my wrist. Put me in a hard cast. And 2 days later, I went back to the hospital at 6 in the morning, cut the cast off. They strapped me up. I came out to warm up. And the first ball I hit in the warm up, it was so excruciating that I couldn't even warm up the morning of the match. So I asked Dougie Spreen again. I said, what do you think? He said, this time you're not playing an American, so we'll still say the same thing to you. You're risking your career. I asked the doctor. He said, I second Dougie's opinion. I asked my dad, and here's the magic of my father, is that not just is he my best friend or my hero or my North Star, but he's such a master of human psychology. And he said to me when I asked him, what do you think, in that locker room in Atlanta in Stone Mountain, just before my bronze medal match, he said, it's not about what I think. Both you and me know you're going to play. Both you and me know that you're crazy enough to play.
Did you know that at that moment?
100%.
So you were asking him for reassurance?
Exactly right, as I always do. He's always been my confidant. No matter whether it's with my sport or my body or in a cancer hospital or in life. I think that's what parents are there for. It's just confidence.
And so how did you get through that match? And more to the point, how did you win it?
lost the first set. Was down 1-2 in the second. Down break point. Won the second set. And from 1-2 break point down in the second, I just got into a zone. I just got into a place where I understood very quickly that if I had lost that break point, my Olympic dream was coming to an end. I had to wait another 4 years for it. And I was able to understand that that match that day was not about technique. It was not about physical fitness or injury. It was about mind over matter. It was about my...
And heart?
Complete heart. My whole life has been about heart. I've been the underdog every time I've gone out onto a tennis court. I've been an underdog coming from the place I was born in. So life is about heart with me. That's the brand of tennis I play.
So how did the mind over matter help you? I suppose you were in the zone and then you just rode the wave, did you?
I managed to, within that time, even with an injured wrist and even with, I would say, 40% of my repertoire because of the injury, I managed to find my legs in the match. I managed to find my heart in the match. I managed to find the Indian crowd and fans and the Brazilian crowd and fans that were cheering for him turned around and started cheering for me because of the heart, the legs, and the passion I was playing with. Everyone knew I was injured, but I found a fifth gear in my game, and I found a fifth gear in my mind to play simple tennis. Chip in charge, first serve percentage high, play volleys into the open court, and use my legs so fast and so strong that I've never used them before. I think the thing I learned about the human body and mind is you might have an injury or a deficiency on one side, but it enhances the senses on the other side. It's just a matter of being open-minded to see where. And that day I found that first my legs were doing things that I never imagined they could do. I was reaching balls with my legs and jumping for smashes with my legs that I never knew I could hit. I also found a sense of drive in the pain that was in my wrist. I found it in my belly and my heart to push my body and push my tactics and push my emotions beyond the pain of the wrist. And I think that's what life's about. We all have challenges. We all have stresses. We all have certain deficiencies. But it's about opening the mind to master that task. The simplicity of mastering the task was what I managed to figure out that day.
And how was it then on the podium? You didn't get your national anthem played because that only goes to the gold medalist. But standing on the podium with Agassi and Sergio Bruguera, what did that mean to you?
Well, firstly, as I won the match, Melingeni was in tears because he knew that was his match to win. And he is one of my best friends, so I gave him the longest hug and he cried on my shoulder. It also made me realize that how quickly I could have been on the other side. So a sense of gratitude, a sense of appreciation, a sense of empathy, and also a sense of learning that in our sport of tennis, you don't have to be perfect every day. It's just as in life, you don't have to be perfect every day, but you got to master the day. Every day we are set with certain challenges. And if we can use our God-given skills or our practiced skills to master that challenge every day, just to be happy, just to find a little success.
That was the pinnacle of your singles career. And it's interesting that by the time you won in Atlanta, you had a very effective doubles partnership with Mahesh Bhupathi. So there was another Indian coming up who you could play doubles with. Although, ironically, you never did that well in the Olympics with him. But you were a phenomenal pair. What made you and Mahesh so good?
I think our cultural similarities. I think his strengths were my weaknesses. My strengths were his weaknesses. I think in the initial stages of our partnership, we just gelled so well. We understood each other. We unconditionally supported each other. We were willing to go down into the trenches and fight for each other. So going off and playing in towns in Prague and smaller tournaments in Uzbekistan, Fergana, Andijan, Jakarta, Guayaquil, Colombia. We went off into these small little towns and fought hard to sharpen our skills as a doubles team. Learn about the camaraderie and the communication and the early calling to cover the court where the sum of two individuals were greater than two. So when we were on the court, we dressed alike. Our shirt, shorts, socks, shoes, hairstyles looked alike. So no one could tell who was the taller one or who was the faster one. No one could tell when we were at the net who was where. Because then it allowed me to use my speed to my advantage. When the ball's traveling at 143 miles an hour, the opponent only has a fraction of a second to think. And if I can maximize my movement within that fraction of a second to show my opponent that I'm actually covering the line, and when they hit into the open court, cross court, I'm still there. Suddenly, the sum of two individuals becomes greater than two.
You played with a lot of different partners, and without us wanting to get into any detail, you and Mahesh struggled with the personal relationship off court. To what extent is playing doubles a bit like a marriage, in the sense that you have to be an item, and yet at the same time, you have to be two individuals?
I think there are a lot of similarities. I think that just as in a relationship, I've never been married, so I wouldn't be able to comment on that.
I used the term marriage in the broadest sense.
That in that, I think in a relationship, you got to celebrate the individuality to enjoy the partnership. Because otherwise it seems like it gets boring after a while. The mundaneness of a relationship where you spend majority of 24 hours with one person, you not only know their dress sense, their food habits, their shower timings, their brushing their teeth timings, the way they think in different situations. I think it's very important to celebrate the individuality because it makes it more fun for oneself. But I also think it's very important to have like-minded people who think the same. Because if you don't, that's when the friction comes in. It takes two hands to clap, but if one hand is willing to clap and the other one's not, then it breaks.
Doesn't make much noise.
No, it's quite a lot of silence, eerie silence. But there, I think what I choose to remember is the magic we've done together. I choose to remember the camaraderie, the respect, the ability to prove to Asian children all across the world that if you work hard enough, you can be Grand Slam champions too. My vision when I first saw Mahesh when he was 14 and I was 15, I asked him if he'd like to win Wimbledon and he laughed at me. And now when I look back at the old roles of 1999, when we won Wimbledon together, he covered his face in disbelief. And I had a little smile on my face saying, yeah, we did it.
Because in 99, you actually did the pure calendar Grand Slam of reaching finals of the four majors. You were runners-up at the Australian and US Opens, but you won the French and you won Wimbledon. Given everything that Wimbledon had meant to you as a boy when you first chose to play tennis, what did that actually mean in terms of your own experience of it?
This is why I love interviewing with you, Chris, because not just you're a historian of our game, but you make it so much fun to go down memory lane. And I would like to take a time to tell you how much respect I have for you and how much fun I have every time I chat with you to inspire kids and people all around the world.
That's very kind of you, but I'm just trying to bring out the best in you in this interview.
Winning Junior Wimbledon in 1990 gave me a belief that I had a chance in a sport of tennis that I didn't feel that I was talented at. Winning two Wimbledon titles in 99, both the doubles with Mahesh and the mixed doubles with Lisa Raymond, I stood in the Royal Box different times of Sunday thinking, I really got a good chance of making a living out of this. And also at the same time, getting to all four Grand Slam finals was just a reflection of the hard work we had put in for 5 years as a team. In the trenches, learning the craft, learning the backhand cross courts, learning how to kick a serve and the other guy covering the center, learning how to, the timing of our crossing and poaching at the net, the patterns that we learned, the ability that we played off a pattern, but yet were able to take over with leadership. It's like jazz music, right? You got to learn the jazz first before you can play off the beat. And that was the beautiful part about doubles, is that with 194 partners that I've had in the men's game or 26 partners I've had in the mixed doubles game, I've always tried to be the jazz, make them feel happy, adapt myself to their game, learn their dialect, learn their language. Why? Because I felt it would be much easier for them to understand a dialect or a language that they were familiar at, to go left or right or yours or mine or jump or duck in their language and react in a fraction of a second compared to them learn Hindi. Secondly, it was more fun for me to be a student of my craft and a student of life, to educate myself through the different partnerships I had, train in their towns, in their villages, in their countries, live there, learn the food, learn the culture, learn the dynamics, because I went a little deeper with every partner I had to learn about their strengths, their weaknesses, and their vulnerabilities. So as a partner, I would protect their weaknesses and their vulnerabilities. And wherever their strengths were, I sat back and watched the fun.
And do you like jazz in terms of music? I love the analogy with jazz, but do you love that music?
I'm a trained street jazz dancer. I love the rhythm of jazz because you can play it at a four-step, a two-step, or an eight-step.
And so which jazz musician should play the soundtrack to the film of your 1999 Wimbledon title?
My favorite is Dizzy Gillespie. He's one of the great saxophonists of the world. And I love his country, Cuba. And going down to Cuba and down into those little jazz bars and not only seeing those fancy colored cars that are out there, not only seeing the diverse in culture in the society, but just music's a way of life. And I think if you watch a lot of my old roles and my archives of my matches, and you look at how I organized my feet in preparing for a volley or preparing for a shot, it was always on a 4-beat, a 2-beat, or an 8-beat. Depending on my opponent's rhythm, if they like playing quick, I played 8-beat really slow. If they like playing a 4-beat, I played really fast off a 2-beat.
And were you conscious of that as you waited?
100%.
Because I was counting.
I didn't have the forehand and backhand to challenge them, but I had the rhythm of a human being and I had the intellect and the speed of my feet and my brain to strategize against them. And my rhythm was my jazz.
I know you got under the skin of a few of your opponents. A lot of people who have great respect for you so say, I occasionally came off court thinking, I'm not going to lose to that guy again. What was it about you, do you think, despite all that you stand for, all the wonderful attributes you stand for, that actually irritated some of your opponents?
I think some people like heavy metal. They don't understand jazz.
And like the musical analogy.
And that's all right. I think 99.99% of the world love and believe the way I play my jazz. I'm not out there to please everybody. I'm not everyone's cup of tea. I'm not everyone's jazz music. But I have my own brand, and I believe by being true to myself and being real about who I am and what I'm about, if I can inspire 250 million children to play sport and have a better life, then on my tombstone it'll be just the musical notes of a jazz player.
We've talked about your successes. There was one moment in 2003 when you had a suspected brain tumor. You've made reference to having been in the cancer hospital. Fortunately, it turned out to be just an infection. But in that period, before you knew about it, what did you learn about yourself?
You know, it caught me by sudden. I wasn't prepared for it because I was in the on center court in the middle of a mixed doubles match with Martina Navratilova. And it was the quarterfinals of Wimbledon in 2003. I jumped up for a smash and I lost my eyesight. And I had the presence of mind to drop my racket and cover my head when I came down like a ton of bricks. But when Dr. Tudor Miles came out onto the court to check me out, he's like, this is too dangerous for you to play. While I was on the side of the chair, my eyesight came back. And none of us knew why or how, but you can imagine how frightening that was. But I promised Dr. Tudor Miles that I only needed 10 minutes to finish this match because we already are setting a breakup on the scoreboard. And after the match, he could take me to get an MRI and figure out what he was, but he needed to give me 10 minutes so I could finish the match and win and get to the semifinals. And he had to sit on the side of the court. And he was such a wonderful gentleman. He obliged and he sat on the side of the court. I ended up winning that quarterfinal match in probably 8 minutes later. And then after the match, a shower changed and he took me to the hospital and they found a tumor on the left occipital region of my brain. But the unique thing at that time, Chris, was that that tumor was moving. And whenever it sat on my optic nerve, I would lose my sight and I was getting these seizures. But whenever it would sit off, then my sight would come back. So I played the semifinals and I played with 104.3 fever. I played with a thumping headache. I had a really bad sore throat. So he gave me a lozenge to coat my throat called Dequacaine. It was benzocaine in it. I only tell you that for the reference later. But I was lucky I didn't have any more seizures in the semis and finals. Martina Navratilova and myself created a record for the oldest mixed doubles champions in age. And also she was 50 at the time that we won. And to me, she's the greatest ambassador of women's sport and of all sport because of her true tenacity and a true realness of which the way she commands her brand. I don't think you could get a truer character. What you see is what you get with Martina, and she's such a great inspiration for equality in our sport of tennis. And I'm so proud to say that tennis is the first sport that has equal opportunity for boys and girls, equal scholarships thanks to Title IX in education, and also equal prize money for boys and girls. And Martina and Billie Jean and that group were great to do that. But coming back to your question, the Monday morning after I won Wimbledon with Navratilova, I was sitting at home in Orlando, Florida, having breakfast, and I lost my sight again. So I got quite frustrated and nervous about it. So I went and got another MRI done. And the doctors in America basically said, I have a tumor in my brain and it's a cancerous tumor. And they put me into the MD Anderson Cancer Hospital. 6 weeks later, 30 MRIs later, 30 CT scans, 5 biopsies on my arms, as you can see. Here.
Yes, here. Got little scars.
Basically, they could not find anything. And then I got a tropical disease unit of doctors from around the world. France, America, India, Philippines, Dr. Popat. But a Dr. B.S. Singhal at the Bombay Hospital took 5 of my MRI results, 5 of my CT scans, and 5 of the biopsies, and studied them. And 48 hours later, he came back and he said, I don't have cancer. I have neurocystic sarcosis, which is a parasite in the brain. I had already gone through all my medication and treatments and stuff, so it was quite something. I am very, very grateful to the MD Anderson and to all the nurses there, the medical staff there. I owe my life to Dr. Popat and to Dr. Brown and to Dr. Singhal, who found what the actual ailment was. And 6 weeks of steroids later, and that's why I bring up the benzocaine and the decocaine, 6 weeks later, they had to pump my body with steroids to kill the parasite and cure me of the disease. But at the same time, I got a call from the WADA, World Anti-Doping, saying I had failed a drug test at Wimbledon. And then we went back in to the reports because I knew I had not done anything wrong. And Dr. Tudor Miles was so wonderful. He managed to detect it straight away. And he said it was an oral throat lozenge that he had prescribed and given me for the sore throat.
So there's a danger of you actually being stripped of your Wimbledon title.
There was a concern, but never a danger, because Dr. Tudor Miles was so quick on the uptake.
Yeah, fair enough.
That he turned around and he said, hey, it's decocaine. It's a benzocaine lozenge that he was given because of the sore throat and the ailments that he was facing at Wimbledon. But it's amazing how karma and life is. I'm so blessed to have gone through so much in my life. And that's the reason I bring up all these little anecdotes, because it's almost like a reflection of how tough it is to be a champion. Every generation has their hardships. Every generation has their stresses. Every generation has their hurdles to climb. My favorite thing to do is to inspire people and share my story with them, that you work for so many years, 38 in my case, eventually to sit back and become a Hall of Famer. And to inspire young kids and families across the world through my story is a responsibility I take seriously and I share with all the rest of the Hall of Famers. And I think that taking the Hall of Fame global is something that's a big passion of mine, through the Be Legendary Foundation, through the Fame team, to inspire young kids through sport, that it's not necessarily just the craft of wielding a tennis racket or a cricket bat or a badminton or a football. It's about physical fitness, mental fitness, and emotional fitness. That's how I became a champion.
You talk about having played with Martina Navratilova and how much you admire what she's done for tennis. What was she like as a doubles partner? Because she's quite demanding, isn't she?
She was a pure leader. She knew exactly what time she wanted to practice. She knew exactly what she wanted to do in that 45 minutes of that practice. She knew exactly what time she wanted to eat or what she wanted to eat. And she was such a champion. She was so focused on perfection. That was such a beautiful learning for me. I definitely bow my head in gratitude to Martina Navratilova to teach me about longevity. Conversations with Martina were unique because she was teaching me about yoga, teaching me about breathing techniques, teaching me about lentils, all the things that we Indians are good at. She embraced the Indian culture. She embraced the Indian food. She embraced the Indian mind. She did yoga every single day of her life. To me, Martina Navratilova is one of my closest heroes that I looked up to, learned the game watching her play on black and white, then watched her play live in color, in person at Wimbledon and French Open. And then I had the good fortune to win the Australian Open and Wimbledon with her. We were a whisker away from winning the French. But to be able to share the court with such great champions and learn from them has been a huge blessing to me. So when Martina came out and did the introduction at my Hall of Fame induction, it was not just daunting because for a young Indian kid from Calcutta who played barefoot in the streets of Park Street, here's a champion who's won 59 Grand Slams. Think about that. 59 Grand Slams. People don't even get a chance to go to Wimbledon 59 times, let alone play it. But to be able to watch her grow, play, partner her, and now for her to do the induction speech into the Hall of Fame, I'm very blessed to have Martina Navratilova in my life, and I'm very blessed to have learned so much from her.
And now you're a Hall of Famer. I'm sure you get asked by a lot of people for advice. We tend to end these interviews by saying, what advice would you give youngsters? Or in some cases, what advice would you give the parents of youngsters who are looking to make their way in tennis?
That's a great one, Chris. I think that parenting nowadays is a tough one because this young generation is exposed to so much so early that the dangers of social media, the dangers of smart gadgets, the dangers of all these fancy apps that are out there makes parenting a real challenge. So almost to guide the parents that the one essential need as a parent is to learn how to give unconditional love, is to equip your children with the tools to tackle the modern world. You don't have to be their best friend. You don't have to be perfect. You just have to be real with them. Because this young generation is going through so much of stress, especially mental stress. It's easy to teach someone how to hit a forehand and backhand. It's easy to teach someone how to lift a weight and be really physically strong or run 100 meters. But the mental side of the game, the unconditionality of building character and how to handle stress, that is where parents come in. The unconditional love that a parent should give a child is the greatest message that I want to send out to all the parents. To teach through fear doesn't last. But to teach through love leaves a DNA in that child's mind even long after you're gone. That my mom, my dad gave me love.
Leander Paes, thank you so much for sharing your life in tennis.
Chris, you're magic. Thank you, my man. So much love for you.
What a teacher Leander Paes is. Spirituality, parenting, inspiring others, he simply has it all. And if you are wondering about the Be Legendary program that Leander mentioned towards the end of that interview, go to tennisfame.com/belegendary. That's B-E-legendary. And you can read all about this recently launched initiative of the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Tennis Worthy Podcast. The interviewer was Chris Bowers, and I'm Patrick McEnroe. Don't go too far, as we have masses of great content coming to you from the International Tennis Hall of Fame. Thanks for listening.